count by twos. So education continues, they multiply the apples, they divide, you move into fractions, cut the apple in four. If you eat one slice, that means you get 1/4 of the apple. So continuing through school, apples become ratios, the ratios of red apples versus the green. Students calculate perimeter, area of a slice, volume, how many 2-inch apples would fit into a rectangular wooden box that's 8 by 12 inches. So by middle school, apples, actual apples, are taking a back seat and letters are appearing. A-P-P-L-E. What happens when a negative letter meets a positive letter? Can you combine a positive E with a positive A? So it gets more and more advanced. Math moves into geometry and students see apples as a bunch of triangles. With sine, cosine, and tangent, they're not so much concerned about the apple itself as they are about its shadow. So if you're really persistent with all this apple learning, then you reach calculus. And so instead of focusing on the number of apples, you focus on how fast the apple is moving. You didn't even know apples could move on their own. And did you know there are imaginary apples out there? So at this point, you're not even sure you're dealing with apples. You're just dealing with the theoretical existence of them. So through this all, from preschool to calculus, we know that students never stop using basic math skills. I mean, adults, we never do. So repetition and memorization of facts are, of course, the bedrock of mathematics. So to remind us of this, I thought we could begin our session in the same way that I begin quite a few of my school days. So for at least 3 out of 5 days after we're finished with devotions, the entire room does a math sheet. So yes, I know these are older students. The more advanced you get in math, the more calculator work you do. And I have just found we just never outgrow our need to stay sharp. And now it varies sometimes. If the room is mostly older students, I don't do it as often as I do if I have 7th and 8th graders. But at least 3 times a week, we generally do a math sheet. So let's just go ahead and keep ourselves both humble and sharp and work on this sheet. So I'll tell you in a moment what to do, and I'll tell you when to start. And in our room, they enjoy the competition. The first one done gets out of their seat and goes and lays the sheet on the desk. So it's kind of their fun to see who gets done first. So in this case, we'll just, whoever is finished, just say done or whatever. And we'll see, I'll see how it kind of compares to the times that my students have. Okay, so on this sheet, for this entire sheet, you will just simply subtract 9. You may go. All right, 2-minute mark. Anybody get finished with the sheet? Yeah. It's good exercise, isn't it? Oh. And I feel like, as teachers, we should probably be the fastest ones in the room. I mean, or at least give some very close competition to the fastest students in the room. So, and I do have to keep on my toes, so I often sit there and do one as well. So, by a bit of introduction, I'm Diana Overholt from Gospel Light School in Lincoln, Missouri. So this coming year will be my 10th year of teaching. So it feels like a bit of a milestone. So it would be my 9th consecutive year since I started teaching in Lincoln. So my husband, Michael, is back here. So he is a great encourager, and he keeps me, he keeps things upbeat by sometimes sending me humorous comics. The latest one he sent, I just have to tell you. So there was a whiteboard with an algebra problem on it, and the boy that was standing before it has just fallen to the floor, and he's clutching his arm. And the teacher is saying, "Oh my, what's the problem?" And the thing below says, "Just as Josh began solving the equation, his fiber, my algebra, started acting up." So I enjoyed that one. But anyways, you know, there's so many different ways we could take this class. You know, I was thinking it could be interesting to follow the evolution of a fraction as it travels through the grades and becomes a complex rational expression, or it's used as a fractional exponent to express a radical. But I met up with a seventh, eighth grade teacher from another state soon after I had agreed to have this class. And in the course of conversation, I asked what he would like to hear discussed in a session like this. And he didn't hesitate. "How can I get my students to like math?" he said. You know, it seems like there was negative peer pressure among his students about math. They thought they hated math, and they said as much. So do we all understand his dilemma, or have we all heard that? Or heard that when we went to school? Is that very, I felt like I could understand his dilemma. Well, this past year I had two seventh grade boys who had no problem understanding mathematical concepts. And in fact, they both had A averages. But yet I would periodically hear from the more vocal of the two, "I hate math," you know, said with a sigh after the day's lesson was finished. And I know this isn't necessarily, it's not like it's like a Mennonite problem or something. I think it's something that's kind of seen everywhere, because our son's fiance, who is majoring in biomedical engineering and incidentally loves math, said that her calculus professor lamented to her that so many students are just trying to put in time and get this required class over with. They don't get to the place where they enjoy the process of math. So that brought the question, what can we do to nurture a mathematically positive atmosphere in our preteen and young teen students? So this session I felt like was just what I needed after 9 years of teaching. So I'm just challenging myself on how I'm presenting math. Before we go any further, we could discuss this "I hate math" thing a bit, and I'm glad if it's not something that you hear very much. I actually hear it more from, I would say I probably hear it more from adults than from my students. And, you know, what would cause it, what would cause a student to dislike math?
If it's hard for them.
Yes. And, you know, if they get behind, they're frustrated easily. Or if they haven't mastered previous concepts, mm-hmm. That's a huge thing. Oh dear. But yeah, it can be a negative peer thing. Or they may want to get it, they want to get it right away, and they don't want to put forth the time and effort for it. I think that's probably what we run into more in our schools than anything, is that it just takes time. And they want to be finished with math. So I don't know, does anyone have a premeditated response when it's said to you, or what you say back to them?
You don't have a connection to life.
Exactly.
Well, I would all know you love math, or try to give some kind of exciting thing that involves something that I know that they like, and involves quantities of some kind or another. You know, that's math.
Yeah.
You know, one way or another, you love it. It doesn't work very well, but as far as changing their mind.
Yeah. Well, you're touching on the thing that, I would like to bring out. So on an online forum, one teacher said, skip the sympathy. She said, it doesn't work to say, this is a bit of a pain, because the students will copy your attitude. So be the positivity that they need. And another one replies, well, you haven't had me as your math teacher. And one suggested asking, what maths do you hate specifically? This was to adults. She said, you're all right with money and time because you're here. So, but, you know, grade 7 to 10, it's not too late to start really liking math. You know, in fact, these years can be the turning point as they catch their own responsibility and find satisfaction in doing more advanced work. So, yeah, just keep all this in mind, I guess, as we talk about the points. Number one, rules rule, facts are factual. We already touched on this through repetition and memorization. We learn facts. You know, there's no room to doubt, to refuse, to imagine otherwise, because facts are facts. And knowing facts is the very foundation of all further learning. And of course, advanced math only makes sense after you master basic facts. I feel like we all know this. I just want to be clear that we understand this foundation before we move on to other perspectives. So my next question is, have we focused too much on teaching the rules of math? As far as the joy, discovering joy in mathematics, have we focused too much on teaching the rules? So Let's pause for a moment and consider road travel. So bear with me as I ask some simple questions. To those of you who came by car, did you have to follow any rules as you drove?
Yes.
What constraints affected how fast you traveled? Were those speed limit signs meant to be the focus of your journey?
No.
And I agree, when we take a trip, we soak in the scenery and discover new things. But what would happen if we spent our entire trip looking at those annoying speed limit signs and complaining about the rules of the road? You know, we would be missing the point of the journey. And so I was thinking that I think this applies a bit to math. Its rules and facts are like speed limit signs. They're non-negotiable and they're meant to be obeyed. They set important parameters, but they're not meant to be the main focus of our math journey. If they are, we'll miss out on the joy of discovery, even if the discovery is simply understanding what someone else discovered. You know, so what is the goal of math? What is this overlying thing that eclipses rules and facts? So I call it the sovereign perspective. And B, this has already been touched on. I'd love to hear more of what you all have to say. But the sovereign perspective is something greater at work in this world than anything we could ever imagine. The perspective that our universe reveals a math so brilliant that we can't wrap our minds around it. You know, only God could do the incalculable math that sets a far distant planet spinning in tandem with other heavenly bodies around it, or the math behind the rise and fall of the ocean, or the math that created the very time we rely on. So do we understand how our lives run on math? We practically live and breathe in a world of math, and yet we can be very oblivious to it. So is this the vision that we need to catch and expand on and share with our students? So before we can nurture enthusiasm, we need to see math in the world around us. So I was pacing in my living room, mulling over this class, and I noticed the swirled pattern in our area rug. And I thought, does it exemplify the golden ratio? So out came a measuring tape. So math was in my mind. I noticed the chicken wire on our farmhouse lamp was a hexagon pattern, like the wax cells of honeycomb in a beehive. So common things, but seeing them in a new light. So if you look around this room, what math do you see in this room? You what?
It's an enormous amount.
Exactly. But let's make this simple for students, and let's talk about the pie in this room. Let's see. Your students know what pi is, but can they explain why pi is 3.1415 and so on? So can you use a piece of string, could they use a piece of string and a round object to prove why pi is what it is? So yeah, everyone has a piece of string, and I used my water bottle. Okay, I went ahead and drew a circle, a round circle on the back side of your first sheet. And I have some, do I have anyone who would like to show us how they could show students what pi is with their string? I'd be happy to have you come up here and do it. I have a couple of scissors if anyone wants to do this.
I want to, I just don't know how.
So pi is the ratio between the circumference of a circle to its diameter. So no matter how large a circle is from a coin to a planet, the ratio will always be the same. Circumference divided by diameter equals pi. So how could we use the string? Any volunteers? This is simply what I did that I would should be. So let's get the circumference. Well, maybe I'll go ahead and, this is going to be fairly. Get the circumference. So I have a string, that's the circumference. And, circumference. Then I'm going to set it down. I'm going to get the diameter. Hopefully I have enough string here. So what you, I'll just make this quick. So if I take this string, the diameter string, and compare it with the circumference, it equals 3 plus a little bit left over. I'm sorry, it might have been, I should have done it a little bit differently, but you can do that with a large object to make more sense. Circle it, and then in every circumference of a circle that you measure, you end up with 3 diameter and a little bit left over. So that's why it's 3.1417 and on into infinity. Let's keep seeing the workings of math around us and explore the idea in number 2, uncover discovery. Let's see here. So I've just cut this apple in half. So if you can see this well enough, you'll see like 5 seeds in the shape of a star. So 5-sided shapes are known as what? Pentagons, yes. And I want to focus on the star shape, which is actually a pentagram, a star-shaped polygon with 5 points, if you want to be precise. Actually, not yet. Star-shaped polygon with 5 points. So a pentagram is described as a symmetry that is worlds within worlds, which means that the shape contains infinitely many smaller and smaller copies of itself. So if you look on your handout with the star down below, to see this in action, connect the star points on your paper with straight lines. Right here's a big star. Go ahead and take your pen and connect all the star points with straight lines. The star as it is 5 congruent isosceles, triangles, that form 5 points with a regular pentagon at its center. But do you see now what has happened now that you have traced? Yes, you have a newly created pentagon, and of course it calls attention to the smaller pentagon that's nestled within itself. So let's talk about that famous number known as the golden ratio, the proportion of smaller parts to the whole. So if you look at your star that you've drawn lines on, we've got 3 lengths of lines here. We've got small lines, medium lines, and large lines. The outer lines you drew are obviously the large lines. The innermost lines of this pentagon are the small lines, and the remaining star segments are the medium lines. So if you would measure them, all parts are in proportion. The medium is too small as large is to medium. So this common proportion is the mathematical pattern, which I'm sure you've all heard about, called the golden ratio, which is approximately 1.618. And it occurs all around us. Here's the actual formula for it. Here we have pi, and then the golden ratio is phi, or depending what some I hear it pronounced phi as well. So this is the Greek symbol. How do you say it?
Phi.
Do you say it phi?
The other one is supposed to be p in Greek as well, but it got anglicized and we now
okay.
call it pi.
So that's
pi.
Thank
is
you.
Correct.
I think I prefer the pi. Okay. What this is saying is if you divide an object by 1.618, it will give you its golden ratio proportions. May I have 2 volunteers? Let's see. Actually, I'll just take you 2 right here. I need you to measure your forearms. Measure your forearms from the tip of your elbow to
which finger?
To just the end of your finger.
Which finger?
Actually. Just from the tip of your elbow, this should be roughly, tip of your elbow to the tip of your finger. Okay. Yes, inches. Tip of elbow to tip of finger. Now, if you have calculators or use your phones, divide that number that you get by 1.618. Yeah, now just divide that number that you got by 1.618.
Would be 12.67 if it's at 20 and a half.
Okay, now check. Now check again with the measuring tape and see if that is ends up exactly at your wrist. From, yeah, start from the elbow to your wrist. Yeah.
What am I supposed to be?
Yeah. So the forearm divides at the wrist, which is the golden ratio. So if you divide your height by 1.618, the answer should be the location of your navel. So, you know. And you often see a shell depicting the golden ratio because that swirl is occurring where the length is divided by 1.618. So it's interesting where the golden ratio appears. While studying this, I found someone used a side view picture of President Trump's head to trace the golden ratio, and his ear was the spiral. So I can see. So, moving on to B, let's talk about triangular numbers. Square numbers and cube numbers are pretty familiar, but what about triangular numbers? So, give me a moment. I'm going to arrange these apples in a formation like bowling ball pins. Don't know if you can see them or not. Hold on here, I did something, 1, 2, 3. Okay. Yeah, I had more apples than I thought. Okay, so we have 10 apples here. I don't know if you can all see, these are arranged in the shape of a triangle. I started with one and added one in each subsequent row. So we have 10 apples here. So do you see why 10 is a triangular number? So smaller triangular numbers are also here. So the first two rows make 1 + 2 = 3. So, and the first three rows make 1 + 2 + 3 = 6. So 3 is a triangular number as well as 6. Back to our, so what would be the next triangular number in our sequence?
15.
Yes, thank you. And I just love that there's formulas to find all these things out. And I just went ahead and wrote the formula on the board for finding the what is a certain triangular number. Like if we want to find the eighth triangular number, and I think, is this in algebra 1 or maybe algebra 2? But if we want to find the eighth triangular number, our triangular number 8, we would insert 8 plus 1. Divided by 2. So we have 72 divided by 2 will give us our eighth triangular number. And if you do the arrangement, you will see that it comes out exactly right. So triangular numbers go on forever. So yeah, I think algebra 2 works with arithmetic sequence formulas. And it's also very interesting to explore Fibonacci's numbers or Pascal's triangle. But let's bypass that today and look at how studying triangular numbers helped form the calculus that we have today. So it's 1672, and a 26-year-old man named Gottfried Leibniz is eager to work on a problem that the best mathematicians in Europe are working on. The question is how do you add up the reciprocal of all the triangular numbers? So I went ahead and wrote that on the board here. So we said 1, 3, 6, 10, 15, there's our, so here we have them written, have the reciprocals of the numbers written. And the question was how to add all those up. So At first glance, it seems impossible to him, the sum is endless. Then he noticed a pattern. And I would love, it would be fun to actually have the paper showing how, or the papers showing how it was all figured out. But each number that he wants to add, each number he wants to add together is related to the difference of two consecutive of fractions. So here we have these consecutive fractions. And basically he simplified his formula down to this. There are several, so I mentioned our son's fiance loves math, and so she sent me 3 pages. We went over this of how he came down to his simplified formula, and she had it all explained. If you want to see it afterwards, I can show you. But it does use a form of this. That's one way you can get this formula. But anyways, he simplified his formula to this right here. So Leibniz looked at the tremendous amount of simplification that occurs on the right side of the board, and he realizes that almost everything will be canceled out because the simple fractions appear twice, once with a positive sign and once with a negative sign. So when he does that and the smoke clears, he is left with the only fraction that cannot be canceled out, which is the 1 over 1 times 2. And so he concluded that 2 is the sum of all the terms of the reciprocal triangular numbers. So he went on to apply this cancellation trick to a much wider class of infinite sums, and he called his findings his calculus. So he was one of the fathers of calculus as we have it today. And it was, and part of his journey was investigating triangular numbers. So I just found that very interesting. On to C. Face-centered cubic packing. Let's say that these apples not only look beautiful and delectable, but they're also an extremely rare variety and sell for $100 each, sort of like those valuable square watermelons that are cultivated in Japan. So we're given the opportunity to sell these apples at a farmer's market, but there's a catch. We can only use a 12-inch by 12-inch spot, and we can only create one display for the day. So what can we do to maximize the amount of apples that we display? What would be the best way to pack these? And it would be better if I had oranges instead of apples, but we're using apples today. So the first thing we have to establish is the identifying the shape of the apples. What shape are is the apple? Yeah, it is considered, it's not a perfect sphere, but it's considered relatively spherical. So, and here's an opportunity if you're talking about this with your students. Go ahead, branch into the thing about God's design of the apple. See, not only apples, but almost all seed-bearing fruits are spherical in shape. So what are the advantages of this? There you go. That is literally one reason why they can roll to a further distance, and if they end up sprouting, they won't be competing with the mother tree for nutrients. It'll suffer less damage if it falls. And actually, with no edges on, its surface, its volume is greater. There's more flesh inside it. And then another question, why do apples grow this distinctive dimple? See, a lot of math is asking questions about things that we can make our own deduction on. But there was actually a research team from the University of Cambridge who decided to find out. They mapped the slow growth of the dimple in the apple over a length of time. They applied a mathematical theory known as singularity theory. And here is their conclusion. There is a different rate of growth between the bulk of the apple and the stalk region. They don't grow at the same rate. This results in the dimple-like cusp. So back to our question. What would be the most compact way to pack apples, or let's say to pack spheres? So this is a question long discussed in mathematics, and in 1611, astronomer Kepler formed his conclusion and proposed that the densest way to pack identical spheres is in a pyramid shape. And let's see here. I have that right there. Here is a theorem called the Kepler conjecture. No packing of balls of the same radius in three dimensions has density greater than face center cubic packing. Basically, cubic packing states that you place three balls, or in this case, three identical apples, in such an identically parallel way that the one for the next layer will kind of be setting down in the pocket that's formed by the three above it. So in 1988, a professor of mathematics named Thomas Hales proved it with extensive help from computers, and he published 282 pages of notes. So I have here a much shorter 10-page article that he wrote entitled Cannonballs and Honeycombs. Let me just read from it a bit. So when Hilbert introduced his famous list of 23 problems, he said, a test of the perfection of a mathematical problem is whether it can be explained to the first person in the street. So last year, a journalist from Plymouth, New Zealand, decided to put Hilbert's 18th problem to the test and took it to the street. Part of that problem can be phrased, is there a better stacking of oranges than the pyramids found at the fruit stand? The greengrocers in Plymouth were not impressed. My dad showed me how to stack oranges when I was about 4 years old, said a grocer named Allen. Told that mathematicians have solved that problem after 400 years, Allen was asked how hard it was for him to find the best packing. You just put one on top of the other, he said. It took about 2 seconds. And so he says, not long after I announced a solution to the problem, or not long after he published his 282 pages of proving the cubic packing, he received phone calls from the farmers in the area. We need you down here right away. We can stack the oranges, but we're having trouble with the artichokes. So, you know, and I enjoyed that. And like the grocer, we can make light of this thing of needing to prove something simple. It's common sense to know that apples and oranges can be stacked in this most efficient way. Or perhaps we'll hear our students do the same thing, like, why do I need a formula when I can just figure it out in my head? You know, and this is especially true in seventh and eighth grade when what they're given is not too extensive. But hold the judgment and think about this. And I think we all know this. If there were no mathematicians, no physicists, no scientists who try to figure out why and how something works and create formulas for these things, we would not have the world as we know it today. I mean, not one astronaut would have ever reached the moon. There would be no CAT scans. What there would not be is so massive, I don't even know if we'd all be here together like this. There definitely would be no internet. Let that shake up your students a bit. So are mathematicians and physicists still interested in sphere packing today? Absolutely. So I don't even pretend to understand it, but it now has everything to do with packing data. So think about how we graph two numbers, x, y, on a two-dimensional plane, or three numbers, x, y, z, on a three-dimensional space. So in the internet age, we are now dealing with billions of numbers that need to be contained within a corresponding dimensional space. So each data point needs its own protective sphere, and these spheres need to be packed as densely as possible. Kind of fascinating. So see what's happening here as we examine apples. There's so much potential in them and the world around us for thinking mathematically. And really, it's anything but boring. These discoverers of math are, of the math behind our universe, are getting a glimpse of God, whether they acknowledge it or not. You know, in the Thomas Hales report, he made some intriguing observations about the design of honeycomb. Let me find this. He says, during the 18th century, mathematicians made extensive studies of the isoperimetric properties of the honeycomb and believed the honeycomb to be the most efficient design possible. Here it is in their terms. The cells, by being hexagonal, are the most capacious in proportion to their surface of any regular figures that leave no interstices between them and at the same time admit of the most perfect bases. But Thomas goes on to name a scientist that says three-dimensional honeycomb cells are not the most economical, but interestingly enough, the most economical form has never been determined, he says. So I say God knew exactly what he was doing with the instinct that he gave the honeybees. I had a fun little hands-on thing or whatever with D dividing apples, but I think we better hold that and see if we have time for it. Let's move on to our advice for advancement. So the following points I'm going to give are from a TED-Ed program by Dan Finkel. What he had to say was so relevant, I couldn't think of better points after I heard his. So, A, ask questions. In fact, start with a question and quote from him. Invite thinking into the math that you do. If you rush to give an answer, you rob the students of the opportunity to learn. B, allow struggle. Students need time to struggle. Quote, the only way to teach students perseverance is to give them time to think, to grapple with a problem. And C, you are not the answer key. Quote, inquisitive students are wonderful to have in the classroom. You don't have to know all the answers, and you don't have to feel threatened if you don't know the answer. That was a comfort for me to think about that. But not knowing is not a failure. It's the first step to understanding. By refusing to be the answer key, that you can help create space for that mathematical thinking. So, and along with that, we don't want to immediately knock down our students' ideas. That's hopefully we have conversation going and they're putting some theories out there. So, quote from Dan, it's more respectful to have your theory tried and disproved than to have it knocked down immediately. It's more convincing to be shown you're wrong by your peers than to be told so by the teacher. So, but we, of course, we want to be careful not to end a class with confusion. We need to summarize in a discussion what is correct and what wasn't and why. But just allowing them to think and explore. So what are some ways we make this practical in our classroom? So, you know, Einstein called play the highest form of research. What books are to reading, play is to mathematics. So we can encourage play. As far as in the classroom, I always have a puzzle set up for students who have spare time and want to work on it. You'll find only certain ones gravitate toward that puzzle. But games and puzzles, just, yeah, it's good. Just enjoy play. And for myself, as I was looking at what I can do differently this year, I realized that I had an answer right at my fingertips. So I teach CLE math. That's what I grew up with. I don't know if that's the same for many of you, but CLE has these great features in their math light units. And that is that on the day that they have a quiz or a test, there's always an extra page of some sort of interesting skill or history of math on it. So we've occasionally discussed them as a class, but I've been viewing them kind of as an extra thing that the students don't have to do, because you know what? Students can be very sensitive to what they perceive as extra work. But the fact is that these activities, they precisely illustrate the sovereign perspective that we're talking about. So let's see. So right here in the Algebra 1 is two pages exploring the triangles, numbers and triangles. So I'm feeling like this year, so I consider Wednesday mornings my time to do something a little extra with my class. Last year, that was when we played the dictionary game every Wednesday. So this year, I think it's gonna be math. I'm gonna have something for the whole class, just a little object lesson or something that we'll investigate together. One of the things is what I just gave you. So, I'm still trying to decide how it'll all play out, but there's charts floating around that will get your students thinking. So I don't know if you all had time to look at this. I don't know that I'm necessarily planning to give the answer right now, but you know, if your students start looking at it, they're gonna start noticing the questions that are hiding in plain sight. Like, what's the connection between the numbers and the colors? Why do the numbers in the last column always have orange and blue in them? Does it mean anything that the green spots are always at diagonals? What's with the little white numbers in the segments? Is it important that they're always odd numbers? So, yeah, I'll move on from this, just have fun with it. But I'm thinking one thing I think I'll do is that I will actually, on the days that we have quizzes or tests, I am going to give my students extra points for completing those pages that CLE has. And I'm not sure how it'll all play out, but they'll get bonus points for it or something. So I'm looking forward to that. So, boy, this has went too fast. So in conclusion, there's so much we can learn from math. And a couple years ago, I jotted down some things that I felt like I was learning from algebra. As a Christian, algebra uses what's known to discover the value of the unknown. You know, just like 2x plus 4 equals 10. X is unidentified, but when we do what we're supposed to with the 2, 4, and 10, we discover the value of the unknown x. You know, it's 3. So as Christians, we build on what we already know to discover the value of the unknown. I thought about how algebraic equations have a term called the constant. The constant is a number that is fixed value and does not change. So God is your constant, of course. He has a fixed value. He will not change. And remember that when you face the unknowns, you face them with a constant. One more. Algebraic equations often cannot be solved until you change them into a prescribed form. Then a specific formula works and the answer is revealed. Take the Gauss-Jordan method in algebra 2, for example. You change the given values in a system of equations to ones and zeros, and in the end, x, y, and z are revealed. So answers in life are often not readily apparent, but just because something is confusing and not able to be understood does not mean we don't have a solution. But we have to be willing to change. God may need to change us from a 5 to a 1 or from a 7 to a 0, and then the solutions will become apparent as we let him work. So, it's a journey, and I wish you all the best as you go about your school year. I will quickly close with the problem that I was going to. The last part of your page had two apples. So here's the question that you can go with. Three people want to share two apples equally. How can you handle this using only one stroke of the knife? How can you divide them evenly? And here's the thing with math like this, we can quickly rationalize the answer. They'll each get 2/3 of an apple. You know, but math is its own language. It quantifies or proves what is suggested. So think of a formula. That's what I thought we could brainstorm a formula, but I guess we'll... I'll let you guys come up with that. Think of a formula that would actually show how you can divide apples A and B, can equal C. Two apples can be divided between 3. So I think I'll leave it with that, and thank you.
One stroke of a knife?
Yes. Do we need to go ahead?
Yeah, maybe we should.
Well, actually, it is kind of fun, and I cannot take any credit for this because I found this online. Because this is the thing I think with story problems in math is that at first time when you read them, they just sound so confusing. But break it down, and it all makes sense. So let's see here. Do you have any? The thing with one stroke of the knife is a little bit of a distraction. I mean, just for creating the formula. But let me see here. So, all right. So if we have, let me go ahead. So A plus B need to equal, the volume of apples A and the volume of apple B needs to equal apple C, right? And we need to divide it into 3. So we're going to, let's go ahead and set this where, of course, the 3 will cancel out, and we'll have A plus B equals 3C. Okay, so basically then, let's see here. We need to make a cut. Before we make a cut, where's my knife? Boy, that's not good to have a knife floating around.
Right here.
Yeah. So we need to make a cut in both apples A and B. Let's see. So that the bottom, make a cut in apple A so that the bottom part of it equals C. The bottom part of it will equal A and the part above will equal C. We need to make a cut in apple B, so the part below it equals B, and the part above it will equal C. So you align, basically, you align the two apples, and you're going to, we can solve the formula. You make one cut through the top, and so, let's see. So you give C to the first person, C to the second person, and then you look at the leftovers. It's going to be the two pieces added together that equals C. If we set it to, well, I should have done some more bookwork. Anyways, A plus B, A less C, and B less C, and you combine them together, sets to equal 3C, and so you substitute, you go back and substitute, and you end up with 3C less 2C equals C. Okay, very simplified version, but it's kind of fun. All right, thank you.